Since he graduated in the early 60s, he's produced over a dozen volumes of poetry and appeared in countless magazines and anthologies. Unfortunately, the Penguin Modern Poets Edition is now out of print, but we've got a few copies here of his latest two books, HMS Little Fox, published in 76, and his latest book, Boston Brighton, was last year published. The last 15 years have seen Lee work on a variety of things, having to perhaps sometimes, like a stonemason's mate and a bus conductor, writer in residence in the School of Fine Arts in the Greek Islands, forestry worker in Gloucestershire, all this interrupted by frequent visits to North America. By day at present, he works in the post office in Brighton, and by night, well, tonight at least, he's having a meet for us, so Lee Harland.
Okay. Right. I thought of reading for about half an hour, since I don't think anybody can take more than half an hour of poetry without going to sleep. I mean, no matter how good or bad, one's attention span is limited because of the demands that most poetry makes on your attention. So I reached for, say, half an hour, and then we'll take a quarter of an hour break. I don't think we can go anywhere, but we can sort of take a break. And if you want, I'll gladly answer any questions or whatever. And then I read for another 25 minutes, half hour or so. Most of my work shuttles in between being, I mean, amongst other things, between storytelling. Maybe the stories are sort of fragmented and collaged together, but the drive is storytelling. And at the other sort of puritanical extreme, trying to write as clearly and accurately and directly as possible. Ideally, that the two should come together, but sometimes pushing either approach, the act of writing as far as it goes, and then marrying them, can have effects which can be even more fruitful. The story thing, of course, is something very hard to talk about, because it's, beside literature, like Pound saying, being to do with curiosity, it's also to do with stories. Like, why as kids do we love being told stories? Why as grown-ups do we love it when some older person tells us some long rambling account, or maybe probably a really minor fact, but the way they tell it grips us. We don't know why it grips us, but it grips us. It's that love of being told stories. In the same way that, say, in North Africa, you have, I don't know what you call them, poets, that go from oasis to oasis, small town to small town, and sometimes they retell traditional stories, sometimes the stories they made up themselves. Either way, it doesn't matter. What matters is the way it's told. And accordingly, the storyteller is rewarded. Which, for me, in times of self-doubt, is sort of, it feels that that's one of my justifications for being a writer in society. I'd like to read about seven texts, maybe eight, in this first half. The first one is titled Sea Journals. The logistics of the piece, if it's ever to be printed, ideally would be two parallel texts. One is on the coast looking out to sea, and the other one is out to sea looking towards the coast, which may not mean too much here in Coventry, which I guess is as far from the coast as you can get, you know. But once you live by the sea, you can never go inland. Inland people are different. On the coast, one, there are so few words to use to say what fills me. The sea, my family, walking on the hills. Two, the sea, And that thin, luminous strip on the horizon where sea and sky meet, where they flow into one another at certain times. Off the coast, one. Mid-afternoon in mid-May, a ship lying off the coast off Shoreham Harbour, waiting on the tide to enter port. The sound of the waves slapping against the side, the black iron plates thick and heavy with many repaintings. The wind rattling the metal lines against the metal masts. A clear, bright day, the sun hot in your arms as you sit outside the galley taking a breather, the deck in front of you littered with potato peelings and a few eggshells. All the clutter of the stern, the smells of the galley, the deck, the ship. The engines quiet, still. The hot and clean, fresh wind from the southwest. Looking towards the shore, the houses and docks and the green hills behind them, so clear you feel you could almost reach out and touch them. On the coast, three. Waking on April mornings, the town covered in, filled with sea mist, and then walking downhill to work, the mist and the sea stretching off in front of you. Four, though to resist the urge when so struck dumb to turn to the encyclopedia, the textbook, where you can see how things work, which is a little use, even the optics of it, but the exercise useless in the face of the sea's presence, where the words once more melt, are of no use to say how it really works. Five. This island, the continents, floating on the waters, clinging to the planet's surface, a skin so thin holding a ball of liquid fire and water. Six. Vast green sea, waves breaking far out from the shore, bright midday of spring drizzle and strong westerlies. The last part, off the coast, two. Barnacle Bill the sailor had a dream that night. He dreamt that Ibn Abdi Rabihi, the much loved and respected Islamic poet and scholar, was one evening sitting to sak. On his knee, he balanced a transistor radio tuned into Radio Cairo. The radio was playing a continuous program of Arab popular songs. The toilet window, which was open, overlooked a lush walled garden. And since it was dusk, the garden seemed even the more lush with its dark foliage and plants still dripping with the rain from a recent thunderstorm. The humid evening's quiet was only broken by the wailing songs on the radio. And Ibn Abdi Rabihi thought, as time drifted by, of the roses flowering in that garden, and considered the similarity of a rose to the sea, of how, since both were creations of his mind, ideas that eternally existed in his knowing and his knowing, that there really could be no difference between the two, despite their apparent individual beauties. You remember those lines of Muhi al-Din ibn al-Arabi in his poem Fuzusu al-Hikam, quote, "How can he be independent when I help and aid him? For that cause God brought me into existence, and I know him and bring him into existence," unquote. And also in the collection of odes, Tajumanu al-Khaswar, he'd written, quote, "My heart is capable of every form. Love is the faith I hold. Wherever turn his camels, still the one true faith is mine," unquote. On the same night, Lawrence Hammond, second mate on the steamship Charterer out of Lowestoft, was on the bridge on the middle watch. There was the usual yellow glow of light from the instruments and the sound of the engines he had known so many other nights as the charterer ploughed its way up the channel. There was a light squall, and he could hear the hiss of the waves as they curled past the side. As he leant forward, trying to look out at the night, he noticed large drops of water on the outside of the glass screens of the bridge. The sight of them completely filled him, and he remembered the droplets of water that sit on a rose after a summer shower. He was back in that summer day, the sea a thin band in the distance, and the skylarks twittering in the sky above. A couple of shorter pieces. First one is for my young son Rafe, which I'm very proud to say is going to be published in the Journal of Child Psychotherapy, which is far more impressive for me than being published in some dumb literary magazine, because in literary magazines everybody says, oh, this is literature, whereas you publish in some sort of newspaper or scientific journal, people believe what you say. It's like Cocteau says, poets don't want praise, they want to be believed. The title of the poem is Plato, Dante, Pound and Co. Give up, but try. That dumb paradise beyond the words that no one can write from Plato down to now. Quote, now the heaven which is above the heavens, no earthly poet has sung or will ever sing in a worthy manner. Unquote. Whoever, all those great men, no competition, only left with let the wind speak, that is paradise. And this, talking the joys of children, the paradise of them, can only be known by those who have the children. You, my baby son, whether seeing your smile or hearing your laughter or just the two of us hugging, it's that. No words beyond the bare account. It all breaks down, which is as near meaningless as most such phrases, but a general collapse of the words. Mr. Jung, forget your symbols. Beyond them, son of, son of, son of. That joy, your smile as I hold you in my arms. My childhood, no memories, only old photos. Wore on farther away, windows taped to reduce blast of splintered glass from the bombings of said war. Only old photos of this, no memory. Only knowledge of what the fathers missed, what we kids missed. The hugs and paradise of being together. But to tell it as a story, as though to someone else, the distance somehow hazing the sharpness of this knowledge, it won't do. The other piece is a text to go with an engraving by Roger Tomlin. Quite a bit of my recent work has been in collaboration with various graphic artists or with various illustrations. The quote at the beginning is stolen from Robert Louis Stevenson in the introduction to The Weir of Hermiston. Quote, in the wild end of a moorland parish, far out of the sight of any house, there stands a cairn among the heather, and a little by east of it, in the going down of the brayside, a monument with some verse half defaced. It was here that Claverhouse shot with his own hand the praying weaver of Balwearie, and the chisel of old mortality had clinked on that lonely gravestone. Unquote. For on 8th July 1853, Commodore Perry sailed into the Bay of Yedo with his squadron of four U.S. Navy ships and established a base at Luchu, Okinawa. And so one form of ritualized barbarism replaces another, I guess. The Japanese woodcuts portraying those four tall black ships have a beauty in their colouring which is a far cry from the probable ugliness of the incident. Though these facts were so remote from her, she could certainly imagine 17th century Scotland or the establishment of Western capitalism in Japan as she sat that afternoon in the top room. All around her were stacks of slightly worn and dusty furniture, piles of books, and large trunks filled with mementos and things that will come in useful someday. Outside, the countryside and gardens were sodden, the rain-soaked long grass bending over the swollen streams, wet gusts of wind shaking the trees. In a late autumn such as this, she could only sit as though frozen for afternoons that never seemed to know any progress. She imagined what it must have been like for Robert Louis Stevenson in the South Seas. How would his afternoon have gone at the Vaiuma estate on Samoa? Until about 2, when I turn into work again till 4, full from 4 to 4:30, tired out and waiting for the bath hour. 4:30, bath. 4:40, eat 2 heavenly mangoes on the veranda and see the boys arrive with the pack horses, he said. In fact, I found out that when I first came across that Stevenson thing, I assumed old mortality was one of those fictional tricks, like talking about fate pointed its finger or something. But there was an old man whose real surname was Patterson and who was nicknamed Old Mortality, and he used to go around carving gravestones where various of the early Protestants were martyred within Scotland. So, stranger than fiction. Another prose piece, whatever the label is. This is titled Kennebunkport, Maine, USA. Kennebunkport is, as you'll see from the text, is a small town up on the east seaboard of the United States, near almost into the Canadian border. I worked there for about 8 months at a very ritzy restaurant. I mean, so ritzy you wouldn't believe it. I mean, if you were sitting at a table, I would arrive and do your cocktail order and show you the menu, discuss it with you. And then I'd have a backup waiter who'd actually put the plates on the table. Then I'd have a young boy who'd fill your water glass. I mean, it's called the White Barnum. And I got extra tips because I was the English waiter. And that meant that I said banana instead of banana. And that was extra 5% at least in the tip. In fact, what's his name? I can't remember, it doesn't matter. One paper placemat at the Riverview Restaurant on Dock Square, Kennebunkport. Kennebunkport, the fifth oldest town in Maine, was settled in the part now called Porpoise Beach in 1629. Incorporated as Arundel in 1719, its name was changed to Kennebunkport in 1812. For many years, sailing vessels brought the name of Kennebunkport to every civilized corner of the earth. Many vessels were built on the Kennebunk River, coursing through this town. Later, Kennebunkport was discovered as a summer resort, and again became known the world over. It was here the late Booth Tarkington made his summer residence, and Kenneth Roberts, the well-known novelist, had his permanent residence. Cape Porpoise and Goose Rocks Beach, a part of Kennebunkport, was first sighted in 1603 by Martin Pring. It was on Stage Island in Cape Porpoise Harbour that the first permanent settlement was made in 1629. The town was depopulated by Indians in 1690. Today, Kennebunkport is an artist's paradise, and thousands of visitors come to enjoy its gleaming beaches, pine forests, quaint winding streets, beautiful colonial homes, famous Maine shore dinners, and warm hospitality. 2. Postcard. The old salt along the New England coast. Many is the stories he could tell you of sea wind and salt spray, summer's heat and winter's icy blast on the Atlantic coast. Survivor of a past age, he still maintains his proud independence with dory, lobster trap, and net. 3. Signs along the last 100 yards of the port road before its intersection with the Wells Road, Route 9, going toward town. Kennebunk Port Women's Exchange, established 1919. Home cooked food, bread is our specialty. Cakes, pies, donuts, rolls, brownies, cookies, jams, jellies, or birthday cake. Eleanor Clough. Stop ahead. Reverend R.C. Hewitt. No parking. For sale, Whitecap Realty, 967-3055. Kennebunk Beach, Kennebunk Port, Wells. Village Minimal Bazaar, Sunoco. 4. Postcard, greetings from Maine. Picture of a large lobster painted bright red, collaged in the sky over a view of a Maine fishing town. Maine, Pine Tree State, capital, Augusta, area 33,215 square miles, population 969,265, motto, Dirigo, I guide, flower, pine cone, bird, chickadee, tree, eastern white pine, 23rd state amid the Union. 5. 3 gas stations, a library, post office, several churches, 2 general stores, a drug store, hardware store, and a large number of summer shops filled with artistic bric-a-brac, and a couple of restaurants and hotels. Take your choice. Ideally, that is a model. I mean, if you all did the same thing with your hometown, you'd come up with something more than an interesting text, hopefully. Bright in October. A cloud passes by. The stuffed animals in the museum continue to stare straight ahead. At sea, 3 freighters wait on the tide to enter the small port. Load of timber, cargo of coal. A man walks along the edge of a park beneath the trees that have just begun to shed their leaves. I'm thinking of the forms of peace, or rather, pure pleasure. Read 2 more texts. One is the most recent thing I've written, and it's still sort of being modified. It's a sequence of texts for postcards. I'm working in collaboration with a poet named Tony Lopez. He sends me a card, and I have to write a text for it, and I send him a card, and it builds up from there. Then we edit each other's work. This is has a preface and 6 postcards. Preface. Great clouds of sadness and poverty cross the sky, shadowing the land below and the people's minds, the wind strong and bending the young trees. At the coast there is, yes, a brightness, the crashing of waves on the pebble beaches, the cliffs, a dazzling white wall either side of the haven. The autumn with those weeks of white mist mornings and afternoons where the light itself takes on a golden haze. All of this surrounding and filling us. The giant clouds and the bright sea. First postcard. The Walk, Abertillery Park. To walk the paths where birds sing, to at night see through the treetops the whole scatter of stars. The humans and animals walk out in the darkness, night hunters, while the birds sleep, the planet turns. I can only talk of it such times, the wonder and the loneliness of this. Population figures fade in the apparently endless shelves of statistical registers. Mr. Jameson turned to close the small low gate behind him, then walked at a brisk pace down the road, fearful as ever of being late for work. His telescope and bird books waited in the front room for the weekend. 2. Trist Road, Stenhouse Mule. Proud of watch and chain, proud of stone, solid houses, proud of new coat and shoes, proud of being photographed in this cold, bleak, treeless street. A lump of tenderness sticks in our throat while, quote, sentimentality, unquote, flashes on the screen, but proud all the same of the continual struggle of people to survive and make despite. I've always felt that I was living on the high seas, threatened at the heart of a royal happiness, wrote Camus. And Stevenson, too, on his first long sea voyage, spoke of being filled with a total happiness he'd not known before, his health and spirits being completely revived by the experience. And wasn't it at a cottage in Stenhouse Muir he started to write Treasure Island? Maybe I confuse the names, and the town was really called Braemar. But whichever, a bleak place. 3. Rue de la Pierre, Messine. Camus wrote of Gide. I'd never met him before, yet it was as if we had always known each other. Not that Gide ever received me very intimately. He had a horror, as I already knew, of that noisy promiscuity which takes the place of friendship in our world. But the smile with which he greeted me was simple and joyful, and when he was with me, I never saw him on his guard. And in Messine, the grim peasant we stand around in the cold, bright sunlight of this particular winter's day. The clear blue sky goes unremarked by the mine officials who are busy with their mean business. Hard and mean is a peasant's heart, someone might say. And these, their sons, continue the tradition, even though decked out in uniforms and the occasional modest decoration. In the picture, Rue de la Pierre goes straight ahead, then disappears to the right. And out in the icy countryside, an avenue of standing stones goes its own way, straight across a stretch of bleak moorland, radiating some other kind of strength, and that wonder shut out elsewhere. Yet the coldness that grips one's whole body. Someone unseen opens the double doors within the apartment, and the stranger steps through smiling. We're filled with his warmth, his face like the sun. 4. Maison des Gardins, Route de Gamèche, Tourangue-Mou. To make one song of praise, even on a flat, muddy plain, in weary farmlands and hard factory towns, to praise those gentle and careful acts people do. The family with a large dog that live in a small new house on the edge of town, each with their own distinction, the knowledges and unknown skills of other people, never to be taken for granted, ignored. Each one. Rays of sun breaking through the slate-gray clouds and spotlighting a gentle ridge of hills, a clump of trees, two or three small fields. And in the air, the bird song, the clear music. 5. Blick auf Grimselgebiet. I think of you. I think of the walk down through the pine woods to the village. I think of the questions of affection, of those that were dear to me and those that are dear to me. And at this point, the quiet and loneliness of a deserted hotel balcony overlooking an alpine valley. Yes, here in the mountains, far from any sea, snow on the peaks, the cool air of evening, scented with resin from the pines, early spring. A lengthy description merely buys time can go on filling many pages. The excuses for failure and the inability to clear air in the midst of clear air. Rather sinking back into the luxury of refined loneliness, of cultured thoughts and a general fascination with the finer points. Opening the book he had earlier carefully placed on the white tablecloth, he continued to read a collection of short stories by Bruno Schulz. The beginning of one story particularly struck him with its appropriateness to his present mood. It began, "The demiurge," said my father, "has had no monopoly of creation, for creation is the privilege of all spirits. Matter has been given infinite fertility, inexhaustible vitality, and at the same time a seductive power of temptation which invites us to create as well." The air was so sweet, the white linen of the tablecloth such a pleasure to his eyes and his touch. It seemed anything was possible when he had such a sure sense of where he was and what he was doing at this very moment. Everything would follow naturally from this. The word flow is maybe more accurate than follow. Everything would flow from this without the hindrance of nervous plans or plodding schemes. It would just flow, glide through the air like some amazingly beautiful and powerful bird of prey, like the buzzards that circle this valley. The last one, 6. Quand au jour sur la plage, Saint-Enogat. Two boys splash along the beach, the streaked sky of late afternoon, the grand mansion silhouetted on the headland. As though the sun stranger lay in wait, ready to burst forth, but not today. Let it rest, hugged in the arms of the sea, naked, in birdsong, sea sway. Entering a bookshop in the capital, I buy a copy of de Montelon's Texte sous une occupation, 1949-44. I obviously see this choice because of my great affection for it, as somehow more than apt for my present situation, as though I continue to feel that I too live besieged and threatened by dark and brutal forces. Yet strive in spite of this to be open and fresh to all the wonders that do finally triumph over the invaders. This would be as good a place as any for me to start writing my biography, for anyone to start writing their biography. If anyone wants to see the postcards, they're available. I finished this first set with a thing called Portraits of My Life, which for some reason, again, is made up of 6 parts. I have no idea why this number 6 is fascinating. Somehow it seems to me that if you have 6 parts, thing, the parts can ricochet around off one another sufficiently to get something going. More or less than that doesn't work. This piece, I guess, was started from very perverse reasons. It started because I wanted to write a piece which I dropped as many names as I could, and sort of it's like really aesthete sort of coat trailing. Mainly for one reason, because when I first started writing and publishing about 1960 and onwards, there's a thing that you may have read about in books called the English Beat Movement, and you see before you an aging English beatnik. But the weird thing then was, right until the late 60s, was that you never admitted you listened to music or read books or liked painting or anything. You just had to be sincere and listen to Charlie Parker. And suddenly I found that, okay, things like countryside and all the rest of it are incredibly important to me, but also equally important are books and painting and music. In fact, incredible sense of joy. And so I thought, if this is to be an accurate portrait of my life, I must pull all of those in. And, of course, when you start writing something like that, other things come in that you weren't expecting. Page one. Something passes before one's eyes, or even the edge of one's vision. The swirls of light and crashings of seawater. Redon drew portraits of Bonnat and Vuillard. And the bottom right panel of Giotto of St. Francis receiving the stigmata shows St. Francis plus companion feeding or greeting the birds. All St. Francis, companion, birds, and lone palm tree somehow floating on a cracked gold background. Page two. On the side of the lake, a decaying boathouse, the whole landscape windblown. Waves breaking on the granite boulders that form a promontory beside the boathouse. Up through the trees, the log houses. Maple syrup. Grumio playing Bach's sonatas and parties for violin. Fetch some logs in for the fire. Gin. Thank God for culture. Page three. In a hotel room that seems to be near the railroad station, sunlight is reflected on the worn and elderly furnishings and the woman who sits in a pink slip by the large round table. In the suburbs, a young girl in her early teens stands naked before a mirror in an elegant and large drawing room. Page four. O Princesse de Broly, my body's falling apart, breaking down. The sky blue silk gown slips off your shoulder to eventually reveal your plump white body as erotically delightful as your slow eyes. Discreetly, I leave the salon, O Princesse, in the excellent company of the charming Monsieur Ingres. I turn through winding night streets to the bed of my own dear Madame Dahoud, whose sweet darkness and well-rounded form, my body's falling apart, breaking down. Page five. The fruit is in the bowl, is in the white wicker basket, or lies artistically about the tabletop. The flowers are in the vase. The woman sits beside the vase, thinking, looking off across the room somewhere, her elbow resting on the table that's ruled by the flowers. Oh, girl musicians and dancers of ancient Egypt, oh, handmaidens, oh, queens at the feast, at the festival in Thebes, the wall paintings whose reds and umbers, the sweet life with all in profusion, the luncheon of the boating party by Renoir, the brush drawing of a woman's head by Matisse. Lest we forget. Page six. To the south, the warmth of easy afternoons, of talk, of food and wine, of the easy touch of bodies. While to the north, the chill rain and drizzle that comes between the swimming and bracing moorland walks. Dear Matisse, you know. Thank you. I want to read six texts in the second half. The first one is titled Qasida. If it isn't obvious already, I'm interested in Arab literature. And a Qasida is roughly an equivalent to the Western ode. Though, I mean, I don't think many people would dare write a poem today and title it Ode. And because Qasida has nicer things, implications to it. Officially, a Qasida should start with you praise your horse, and then you praise your weapons, and then you praise your woman, and then you praise your horse again. This is sort of getting rid of the horse and the weapons bit, you know. It's that. The quiet room, the window open, trees outside, blowing in the wind, The colour is called green. The sky, the colour is called blue. Sigh, the cricket singing. Windows open, you move. No, not so much a moving, but the artificiality of containment in one skin. No man, an island. Ha ha, Buddha. Lonesome, huh? The music, the pictures. Go walk about. Small wavy lines on the horizon. Somewhere over the distant horizon, the distant city. I hadn't thought of this, but pull it in. And you. The children are sleeping and you're probably sitting in the big chair reading or sewing something. It's 9:15. I find you beautiful. The words come slowly, no, your tongue, the lips moving, the words reach out, crude symbols, the hieroglyphs, sounds, not pictures. The touching beyond this, I touch you, in the water as though I'm in you, that joy, and skipping in the street, the children hanging on our arms. You know, the signals on the horizon, blocked off, the ships at night keep moving. These clear areas beyond the clutter, that clearing, on summer nights as we lie together. There are green trees in the street. Yes, there's the whole existence of our bodies lying naked together, the two skins touching, the coolness of your breasts, the touch. The setting, it doesn't really matter. We know. So much goes on around us. On the quay, they're playing music. We eat and dance there. When the wind gets cold, we'll put our sweaters on. It's that simple, really. The dry fields. Up on the mountainsides, white doves, of course, glide on the air currents, hang there. Someone said tumble, the sound of words as they tumble from men's mouths, or something like that. These areas, not to be filled, but it's a bare canvas, but not empty, all there under the surface. This is not about writing, but the whole process. You step off the porch into the dry field. You're there. You see, you're there. Now take it from there. Another sequence. Nine parts. Titled Old Bosom Birdwatch. Bosom is a small village on the Sussex coast, southwest of Chichester. One, out of nothing comes, nothing comes out of nothing. Cut, switch two. A small room in a building of small rooms, enclosed thus. Outside there are bare trees groaning and twisting in the wind. A cold, long road with houses either side that finally leads downhill to a railway station. The exit. Two. Out on the estuary, four people in a small dinghy at high tide. Canada geese and oyster catchers around. Pale winter sunlight and cold, clear air. On shore, the village church contains the tomb of Canute's daughter. A black Sussex raven emblazoned on the stone. Small rooms. Three. Sat round a fire, the black Danish raven rampant. In the dream, enclosed, I reach out. She moves in her ways that the fact of closeness, familiarity, obscure. are not quite knowing one another in that sense of clear distance, that sense that comes with distance, like old photos making everything so set, clear and easily understood. So we think. Face to face. The change is flicking by second by second. Not the face fix, that yes, I know her. Not the easy summer qualities. Four. How long since you've known who you are? How long? Why, who you? Don't know. Long time. Only have old photos, old images, old icons peeling. That man who lived at X did Y, traveled to Z and back. The lone gent. Why, who was that masked man? Why, don't you know? No! Five. In the closeness that comes with shared actions, from keeping a room clean, keeping clothes clean, cooking a meal to be eaten by the both of us, in that closeness, mending the edge of losing something, gaining something, questions of clarity and recognitions. Six. We swing hard a port, then let the current take us, the ebb tide pulling us out towards the channel. The birds about, the colours of the sky, the waters, all the different plants growing beside the estuary, and the heavy brown ploughed fields behind these banks. Here more than anywhere else, everything all becomes beautiful and exciting. And the fact of being alive at such moments, being filled with this immense beauty, right, Rilke, ecstasy, makes the fact of living immeasurably precious. Seven. Enclosed by cold in the winter, the clear, sharp days, walking downhill, looking out to sea, the wind up, the waves crashing on the shingle beaches, the days of rain and harsh grey skies, coming home from work in the dark through the car lights and the shop lights. The exit always there. I can't say I know you, but neither can I say what knowing is. We're here, and somehow it works, our being together. Eight. The sky, the gulls wheeling and squawking above, the flint walls of these South Saxon churches, the yew trees branching up into that winter sky. I know these, but not what you're thinking, what anyone is thinking. I can never know that, only work with that as it comes. Open arms, open air, come clear. Nine, last part. The dinghy is brought ashore. The people drag it up the bank and carry it to the cottage where they stow it neatly. Everything shipshape. Out to sea, the coasters head for Shoreham and New Haven. Along the coast, small blue trains rattle along through Chichester, Littlehampton, Worthing, and on to Brighton. The fire is stoked up in the small room. The people in the cottage all eat dinner together, are happy in one another's company. Did I love you? We know this. Parting the branches and ferns as we push on through the wood. I've got a bit of coal, so can you hear me back there?
Yeah.
Okay, right. Just read a short one from about 10 years back, titled Linen, L-I-N-E-N. I for a whole chunk, about 3 months, was doing a reading tour in the States, and I found at the end everybody thought it was about Lenin. Instead. Fair enough. Waking on the purple sheets whose softness, the streets heavy with summer, the night thick with green leaves, drifting asleep we lay. The dazzle of morning, the hot pavements, fruit markets, the avenues. You and I are pretty as the morning. On the beaches, machine gunning the fleeing army, the fighters coming in low at zero, the sun behind them and bombs falling all around.
Ya ya.
Click, click, ya ya. The cheap pages crumbling already after so little time. St. Petersburg, we named the Soviet printing house, maybe. You leave the town. The softness like a banner. The where. In the countryside, the trees bare and scrub bushes scattered in useless fields. The darkness of a stand of larches called the dark woods. On no map. Touching you. Like the... And soft as, like the scent of flowers and like an approaching festival whose promise is failed through carelessness. Another zigzagging back and forth. Recent poem. Title is Afterwards to a Poem by Jack Spicer, and it's this is in memory of Bill Butler, who's an American poet and friend of mine who died in rather kind of bleak circumstances this autumn. Quote, "They've, the leaders of our country, have become involved in a network of lies. We, the poets, have also become in network of lies by opposing them. The BAR which Stan said he shot is no longer used for the course. Something lighter, more easy to handle, and more automatic. What we kill them with, or they kill us with, maybe a squirrel rifle, isn't important. What is important is what we don't kill each other with. And a loving hand reaches a loving hand. The rest of it is power, guns, and bullets." Unquote. Webs of lies upon webs of lies. A spreading mold of hate and viciousness. And death walking among us all. That mean spirits and a dishonest man now hold sway, poison us all with their intrigue and venom, when no hand of kindness reaches out to touch our lips as we pass, as though love were driven out of the town and only left a light in the quiet of a home. And now you gone 3 days with death, and now gone 3 days with death, your big bear hugs, your watch and chain, yourself. We have no words to talk of you, to tell our loss. Only the stuttered conversations on the phone, the broken phrases stood awkwardly round a kitchen, an empty cup in my hand. At this distance, I praise you as the days grow darker and know the impossibility and uselessness of such. You walked past tense, talked past tense, with all the clutter we humans drag behind us were dear to us. Two more. One is a short, one is a long. This is titled, I hear Roy Fisher read here recently. I mistakenly always used to think that the Manchester Guardian Country Diary were all written by Roy Fisher, and that they had these fake names at the bottom, and it was him doing all of them. And eventually somebody told me it wasn't really true. But there's a lot. Then I, when I found it wasn't true, I thought, well, it'd be great if it was true. And the title of this is Country Diary Continued. It's... Let's See, what I'm doing is I'm giving you a load of blarney for a very short poem. I really generally sort of hate, sort of like the Seamus Heaney, if you ever heard him read, he talks about 20 minutes and reads you a 2-minute poem. And the talk is so convincing beforehand, you think this is going to be really great. And the poem is totally lightweight. But it's that thing. And this is one of those things. It's a very short poem. I was working on the buses in between Brighton and Littlehampton, so the Costa Geriatrica of England. And Worthing is the capital of the Costa Geriatrica. And I used to keep a notebook in my marvelous uniform pocket. I worked for Southdown Bus Company, cream of the South Coast. And you'd overhear these incredible conversations, these old colonials, who always used to treat you as though you were some sort of native bearer. They kind of talking about they held their money up behind them for the fares. And that was minor compared. They'd always try to fight with you and have arguments. But the end line of this is one of those things I used to copy down, just to sort of sneak off and write down bits I overheard. And in any sort of affection built up for these people, I don't know why. Equally, there's a Brighton man called Lieutenant Colonel Wintle, who wrote a book called The Last Englishman, which is, one of the things he did, which I love, was a real crooked lawyer, like most lawyers in Brighton, who did this guy's sister out of an inheritance. And so he got the bloke in the middle of Brighton and took his trousers off. And the book is full of things like, oars canter, when in doubt, gallop. So, that's the blarney. This is the poem. Ah, Hilda, my dear, you're so pretty, in a German accent. And the shooting? I used to shoot a bit in Africa, get a duck or so for supper. There seemed to be such a lot of killing going on. I felt I couldn't add to it. I gave up shooting then, except for a little target practice. Lost the taste of it somehow. His patrol was ambushed by Zulus. The two old ladies, the one that had, were ambushed by Zulus. I mean, one of their brothers must have been ambushed by Zulus. The other thing I want to read is, finish with, is an extract from a long work called The Long Black Veil, which in toto consists of a preface and 12 books. Preface. How to accept this drift? A move not mapped nor clear other than in its existence. A year passed. I think of you. It's early on a sunny morning in June. And think of your thinking of me. Possible. How do we live with this? Yet live with this. What have we left from all this? Quote, concepts promise protection from experience. The spirit does not dwell in concepts. Oh, Jung, unquote. Joanne Kiger, the Secchio notebook. 2 years passed. Oh, Jung. The cycle not repeated. Only the insistence. The story is that when a child, Borges used to come to his father. His father would have a number of coins that he would place on his desk one by one, one on top of the other. To be brief, the stack of coins is an image of how our memory distorts and simplifies events the farther we move from them. The first coin is the actual event. The next coin is the event recreated in the mind, the memory. The next coin is a recreation of the first recreation. Etc., etc. But what of the essence of this? Oh, Jung's insistences. The Sufi story of the famous river that tried to cross the desert, but only crossed the sands as water in the arms of the wind. Nameless, but. Book one. The Soft Dawn. It's light. I mean your body and how I ache now, yes, tremble. The words, how can they? somehow the raven flying through endless skies that ache too much, the unbearable distance born. Across the valley, the sun catches the white silos of these scattered farms. Up on the ridge, I mean, following the creek, as we lie in each other, dazed and hanging like birds on the wind. Your body, yes, I'm talking about it at last. I mean, this is the discovery. Need I list the items? On your way from the thorn tree to the house, you stop and half turn to tell me that doesn't matter. But you look, and this picture I have, and at this distance, I have this now. I have what I have in my hands. Dawn, light, body, words, raven, skies, ache, distance, valley, sun, silos, farms, ridge, creek, each other, birds, wind. The flight BA-591. Book 5, Canadian Days. On the northern trains from Toronto up to North Bay, Cochrane and Kapuskasing, then bus onto Hearst, Moose capital of the North, and a jeep ride out to Jogues. The night before, the train full of drunks and bear hunters. Ridiculous. No guffin. And today, early morning, the grey dawn, the towns we stop at, just a collection of huts scattered at random around the rail halt and a dirt road, and then the bush again. Heavy streams and rivers and the forest cluttered with dead and fallen trees. The occasional windswept meadow, a grey weathered farmhouse, deserted, fallen apart, nothing. The bleak empty plain, marsh, lakes, the crowded conifer woods, a single silver birch in the middle of this. The northlands, the watery sunlight on dirt roads, the dull green country, hardly any flowers to be seen. At night, the stars brighter than I'd ever seen them, and the curtains of light, the aurora borealis. This brightness, dazzling, was with you that I wanted. It is the surface, your eyes. The foresters tramp in weary, driven into a corner, so to speak, to say this. I hold your head between my hands, your eyes. In the morning, sitting on the front step, everything so calm and still, the warm sun and a total quiet only broken by the bark of the ravens, the vast blue sky and the forest stretching off on all sides, the long, straight, white dirt roads with a line of telegraph poles alongside, and then the forest enclosing them on either side. Book 6. The Questions of Complexity. On G's death, Mr. Forster said, I realize how clearly, I realize more clearly, how much he got out of life and had managed to transmit through his writings. Not life's greatness. Greatness is a 19th century perquisite, a Goethean job. But life's complexity and the delight, the difficulty, the duty of registering that complexity and of conveying it. The distinctions. O Jung, 1875-1961, on marriage, 1925. The container and the contained, not or. One within the other, a continual shifting, and that both ways, more a flow from the simplicity to the complexity, unconscious to conscious, and then back again. And the move always with difficulty and pain, a pleasure. Not so much a repetition, but a moving around a point, a line, like a backbone, and that too moving, on. Yang and yin, light and dark.
an island set among islands, and that no answer, but the need there, somewhere to have all one's hopes there, to see and touch, to be wholly in one place. Yet over the horizon, as real as any, the ghosts, and them always moving.
Before completion, Wei Chi, 64. But if the little fox, after nearly completing the crossing, gets his tail in the water, there's nothing that would further. In the half-light, a minotaur, a cat, tiger, her face, a metamorphosis, seen at once, many times, our powers generating, we touch, hold, and caress ourself. A bird flying high in the sky above the clouds, and below them an ocean and a ship moving there. Quote, such thoughts were very far from Julien's mind. His love was still another name for ambition. It meant for him the joy of possessing so beautiful a woman when he himself was a poor unhappy creature whom men despised. His acts of adoration and his rapture at the sight of his mistress's charms ended by reassuring Madame de Renal on the questions of the difference in their ages. Had she possessed a little of that practical knowledge of the world which in the most civilized countries a woman of 30 has had at her disposal for a number of years already, she might have trembled for the duration of a love which apparently only existed on surprise and the transports of gratified self-esteem. Unquote. Stendhal, Le Rouge et Le Noir. Right, thank you very much.